So, what I intend to do today is to talk about the conversion itself and the sort of symbolism of the conversion, because there's some quite important elements in that that you need to know if you're going to operate in India. Do you understand my English? Is it? Yes? More or less. more than less, or less than more? más o menos. Yes, so the contents of what Dr. Ambedkar did on that day have important sort of implications for his understanding of Buddhism and for its future. And then, if we get time, I'll talk a little bit more about the Buddha and his Dhamma, especially some of the contentious bits from a Buddhist point of view. So, the conversions took place on the 14th of October, 1956. Dr. Ambedkar, by that time, was already a very sick man, and probably himself knew that he was dying. It was, from a political point of view, a very inauspicious time. There were elections coming up. I think there were state elections coming up, and it clearly would interfere with the electioneering, although presumably it would also have electioneering positives. But obviously a lot of people involved in the political campaign were worried that conversion would then mean that those who didn't convert wouldn't vote for them. So it's quite a bit of background tension within his own leadership about the conversion. But I imagine, my impression is, he knew he had to do it now. In some ways, it might have been better if he'd spent a year or two longer on preparing the ground. Again, it's something I found very difficult to explain to my non-Dalit Buddhist friends in India. They sort of say, well, why didn't he come out as a Buddhist earlier? I sort of try to explain. My impression is that he had a lot of work to do to bring everybody with him. There's a little bit of a sort of hint of this with a friend that we have in India from a Maratha caste, a Shudra caste, the main Shudra caste, although they think they're Kshatriyas, in Maharashtra, the Marathas. Good morning, good morning. Yonapot. I can't remember that. Bunazia. Bunzoa. Thank you very much. Do you want to come over here and have whispered in your ear, the eared whispered teaching? Miklos's English is perfect, so there's no need. Yeah, we have a friend from the major caste in Maharashtra. I think it's about 40% of the population. It's huge. They're the main atrocity makers against Dalits. But anyway, this friend is a convinced Buddhist. He's against caste. He's a follower of Dr. Ambedkar. And he's a big leader of this Maratha caste, in this Maratha caste. But he says that he knows that if he declares himself to be a Buddhist, immediately that'll be the end of his influence. So he has a very delicate task to play. Some people will say something like that, you know it's dishonest. You know that what they're doing is excusing themselves from contaminating themselves by mixing with low-caste people. But in his case, I'm quite convinced that he's a man of honour and principle and very, very intelligent man. So he says he's written a book on the Buddha with a lot of help from us. And he says this is the best thing he can do, is to give people from his community a good idea of the Buddha, so that they'll change their idea of the Buddha. He says at the moment they hate the Buddha. Yeah. But what I'm getting at there through that case is, here's a man who wants to bring people to the Buddha. but he knows he can't do it directly. He has to take steps. And I think Dr. Ambedkar is in a similar position. A lot of people would rely on the gods. They would have a very strong fear of losing their connection with the gods. Political leaders would change their relationship to things. They'd begin to feel isolated and so on. So there's a lot of reticence about this step. I think Dr. Ambedkar took his time because he knew he needed to prepare the ground. Other factors apart. But at this time he knew he was dying. He'd got to take the step before it was too late. And he chose a very particular date and a very particular place. You know that the main Hindu festivals operate on the lunar calendar, not on the solar calendar. So it's a bit like Easter in Christianity, which is a movable feast in the technical language. It changes according to the lunar phases. Well, the whole Indian Hindu religious calendar is lunar. So Diwali, the festival that's coming up quite soon, shifts around. It's not like the 25th of December every year. So the 14th of October that year was part of the Dasara period. Dasara is a very important Hindu festival which it commemorates the victory of Rama over Ravana, correct? My Hinduism is not so good. Manidhamma is the expert. He's not an expert either. Anyway, the 14th of October is the day which actually commemorates that victory. Dr. Ambedkar and others consider that probably originally it was the commemoration of Emperor Ashoka's victory over the Kalinga at Kalinga. When he expanding his empire, he conquered a kingdom in what's now Orissa and stood on the field of battle, having won the victory, and just saw hundreds of thousands of dead. And he was so revulsed by that he decided from then on he would not conquer by war, but he'd conquer through the Dhamma. He espoused Dhamma Vijaya. So from a Buddhist point of view, it's a very, very important point. And an Indian Buddhist point of view, even more important, because it's the occasion when really Buddhism was transferred from a relatively small sectional religion into a state religion, if you like.
So you could say it was kind of Ashoka's conversion.
Yes, yeah, yeah. He may, yeah, you could. We don't know enough really to know what happened, but we do know that. I've been to the very place where he had that realization in Orissa, just outside Bhubaneswara. Very, very moving place to be. Just think that this took place there. And there is a big rock edict in which he makes his declaration, from now on I will not conquer by the sword. So Dr. Ambedkar chose that day because of its significance. And in a way what he was saying was the Dhamma is going to conquer again. India will be conquered not by violence but by the Dhamma. So there's a symbolism that's not often brought out fully in that respect. Secondly, he chose Nagpur, which was at that time, it wasn't anymore, but it had been a quite important city in the very centre of India. If you wanted to find a city that was sort of as near to everywhere, if you see what I mean, the nearest major city to everywhere, it would be Nagpur. Does that make sense? It had been the capital of Madhya Pradesh, central provinces under the British rule. But by that time it had been transferred to Maharashtra. Had Maharashtra been formed then? Yeah. So it had become, from being a very important city, become a relatively minor city. Don't tell anybody from Nagpur that. Manidhamma is only second-hand Nagpurian, but...
It is one of the nicest cities nowadays.
Okay, it's one of the nicest cities nowadays. Completely impartially, Manidhamma says that. Nagpur, he chose for a number of different reasons, but the main one, apart from its centrality, was that it's associated with the Naga people. Naga meaning snake or elephant, but snake particularly. And the Naga people are said to have been tribal people who were the indigenous people of India before the Aryans invaded. It's all ethnographically not so accurate anymore, but the sort of idea is that people in that region, especially the Dalits in that region, are the remnants, and probably this is true, of the indigenous population who were then sort of conquered and imposed upon. In fact, around Nagpur, the tribal people retained political power until the British coming. The rulers were tribals as well. So they weren't even at that stage fully assimilated to the caste system. Just, again, another reason for his choosing that place is that people in Vidarbha, like Manidhamma, tend to be a bit more confident and sort of self-assertive, because they've not been so dominated by caste as people have in Western Maharashtra, where Brahmins ruled very, very strongly. So this sort of connection with the Nagas was very important to Dr. Ambedkar. He said something like, well, this is supposed to be the Naga region, and we are the Nagas. In addition, it's connected with Nagarjuna, the great Indian teacher, the founder of the Mahayana, you could say, loosely speaking. And there is a cave just north of Nagpur, which I've visited, which is said to be a cave in which Nagarjuna meditated. So the Nagas are the non-Aryans, and Dr. Ambedkar said that they'd adopted Buddhism and been the chief force in spreading it. This was his interpretation of things. And we are supposed to be the descendants of the Nagas. There's quite interesting fact that also Nagpur is the centre of the RSS, this extreme right-wing Hindu nationalists movement. Their sort of headquarters, a huge headquarters just outside Nagpur. So the whole massive fundamentalist movement that you heard echoes of in that film last night is directed from Nagpur. Dr. Ambedkar says it's not why he chose that place, but clearly it's got that resonance, as it were. We're in the you know, the brain of the beast. He arrived in Nagpur on the day before the conversions. His very careful organisation had taken place. And this is something that shocked people, non-Buddhist people, non-Dalit people, that Dalits could organise themselves so well. And hundreds of thousands of people poured into Nagpur. Organisation was there to feed them, to house them. They were orderly. He'd asked them all to wear white clothes, and they'd come in fresh white clothes. People apparently would pawn things in order to buy new clothes just for this occasion. And this completely shocked the local people. They just couldn't believe that these dirty Dalits, these dirty Mahars, could behave so orderly, could arrange themselves so well. It was a big shock to the whole city. And a lot of people positively impressed, thinking, well, this is a wonderful thing. He held a press conference, and quite a number of different people came, different newspapers came, because he's a big figure in Indian society, as it were. He's now transcended his Dalit status, as it were, because he's the framer of the constitution. Nehru and so on had all honoured him. And so what Dr. Ambedkar does, people pay attention to. The press conference was apparently quite hostile. The people asking questions were not sympathetic to what was happening, because the press, even today, is dominated by right-wing Hindu forces. For that reason, Buddhists have started their own newspapers. But unfortunately, being Buddhists, they've divided those newspapers into several different ones. the questioning was quite hostile. And for instance, people tried to trick him by saying, well, what form of Buddhism are you espousing? And knowing that if he said this, then that would have this consequence. If he said that, that would have that consequence. So he said, well, we're just Buddhists, effectively. We're following the tenets of the faith taught by the Buddha. And we're not involving ourselves in the differences between Hinayana and Mahayana. And he said, you could even think of this as a sort of Navayana, a new yana. We're not a separate sect, he said, but part of the worldwide Buddhist Sangha. It's again quite important. He's the first person really in modern Buddhism to do something that many others are beginning to do, for instance in TBMSG, FWBO, to think of ourselves as part of the whole Buddhist world rather than as just one sect of it. He was asked why they're leaving Hinduism, and he even sort of kind of covertly criticized by the press questions for doing this. And he said, well, you know, you've ignored us for thousands of years. Why should we stay? What reason have we to stay? You haven't invited us in. It's not as if we're leaving Hinduism. We've never been in Hinduism. And we're just, he said, trying to achieve manhood, humanity. We're just trying to stand on our own feet. Then he made a sort of concessionary comment. He said that Buddhism I've chosen because it's part of Indian culture. I've not chosen a foreign religion. I've chosen a religion that comes out of the soil of India. So he's sort of both challenging and, in a sense, conciliatory. But with very much what Bhante said, this sort of fierce, uncompromising approach. He then said that he expected a huge wave of conversions to follow on from what was happening that next day. And he said that within 10 to 15 years, we could well see India become a Buddhist country. Thank you. Of course that didn't happen. But certainly I think that if he'd lived, there could have been a huge movement amongst Dalits, which after all is quite a substantial proportion of the population. If you add up the 15% and the 7% and a few of the Shudras would probably have followed. And he expected many, many high caste intelligentsia, liberal minded intelligentsia, to think, well, this is the future for India. The conversion took place in a stretch of ground which at that time was on the outskirts of Nagpur. It's now on the right in the middle of it. It was just a bare wasteland with a pandal made out of bamboo and bound together with string, and then cloth hung from it. But a quite impressive one was built. This is a separate trade in India. You can always find a pandalwala who'll put you up. Well, we had for our big retreat a hall for 5,000 people. It can just be put up in 2 days. I've seen them put up for 300,000 people. Massive. Just out of bamboo, bound together with string and with canvas or cotton cloth put over it. Anyway, all that was just the pandal. The rest was open. 400,000 people, 480,000 people. It's not clear exactly how many. All in white. All very, very orderly, which is amazing for a crowd of Indians on occasion like that. It's usually chaos. And on the platform with Dr. Ambedkar and a few political leaders and his wife, there was a group of bhikshus, all Theravada bhikshus, and U Chandramani, who is the senior most Theravadin monk in India at that time, and was, of course, Bhante's preceptor at his bhikshu ordination, at his Shramanera ordination and his bhikshu ordination. And it was on Bhante's advice that he chose Chandramani. At the second meeting Bhante had with Dr. Ambedkar, he had asked Bhante to conduct the ceremony, I think just because he was there. But Bhante had said it would be much better if it was done by a really senior figure in Indian Buddhism. It's quite interesting to think what the position would be if Bhante had conducted that ceremony. It would be a very, very different position. We'd be so much more powerful, as it were. Anyway, Bhante, in a principled way, offered the best alternative. So Urd Chandramani, who's a good monk, and apparently quite a, you know, one of those from abroad who did take interest in India and Indian people. First of all, Dr. Ambedkar and his wife together took the refuges and precepts from Chandramani. Chandramani recited them, and they recited them after him. I should say, of course, that Dr. Ambedkar is a very sick man at this point. We've got pictures of him, very sick man, and he'd, even in his dress, there was some symbolism. He'd wore white, but he wore a dhoti, which is that sort of like gathered up sort of skirt, as it were, like from Yasladanya, Kalo Lassi, he wore, and a long white shirwani, which is an Indian jacket, very, very handsome actually, buttoned high, and a staff, but very sick man, and having to lean on his wife, on his stick, to get onto the platform.
His statue shows him barefoot.
Sorry?
His statue shows.
Well, of course, when you go onto the platform, you take your shoes off. I mean, that's traditional anyway, but yes. Obviously, usually he wore a suit and tie, and quite a good dresser. He knew how to choose his clothes well and so on, and cared about clothes. I mean, not in an excessive way. So he knew what he was doing in choosing this Indian dress. He was sort of making a very strong link with Indian culture and aligning himself with that stream. Dr. Ambedkar, I've more and more thought it'd be interesting for somebody to write a PhD thesis on Dr. Ambedkar's mastery of symbolism. Because all the way through, he is very good at theatre, if you see, like the Mahad Tank, Satyagraha, like the burning of the Manusmriti. He knows the way in which to choose an act and to stage it in a way that has the biggest impact. So you need to pay attention to all the symbolism of it. After he'd taken recited the refuges and precepts, he recited the 22 vows. Then he administered himself the refuges and precepts to the crowd. They were asked, everybody who wants to take the refuges and precepts, please stand. They all stood.
What language?
In Marathi. Mm. Of course, the refuges and precepts were in Pali. There's one of our Dhammacharinis, Jnanashuri, was a little girl at that time. And the children were brought right to the front. So she says that she sat right underneath the platform and just looking straight up at Dr. Ambedkar. And when you ask her about it, you know, tears come to her eyes. And it's a very, very powerful moment for her, defining moment in her life. She told me just on October the 2nd this year, on the 50th anniversary, I was with her. I had the good fortune to be with her at the Dikshabhumi. And she sort of conveyed to me something of the spirit of people at that time. Just they're gathered with a strong sense of joy, of incredible sort of happiness and hope and positivity. She said she'd never experienced anything like it. Just the mood with which people came, and with complete faith in Dr. Ambedkar. The very, very touching kind. And she said that from the Dikshabhumi afterwards, They went home. They lived in Nagpur at that time. They just walked in the door, took the Hindu gods. The first thing they did, just took the Hindu gods from their shrine, from the walls of the house, tore them out, and just threw them on the rubbish heap. And the first thing they did. So this sort of, hard to understand the extent of this this mood of optimistic, deep faith and action that followed on from it. Anyway, back to the occasion itself. Dr. Ambedkar himself took the refuges and precepts, took the ceremony giving the refuges and precepts to the followers. This is extraordinary. In a traditional Buddhist context, every traditional Buddhist context, if monks are present, they do the formal ceremonies. Especially they do the refuges and precepts. And they will be very upset if they don't. So it says quite a lot for Uttarandramani that he let Sangharakshita fulfill this task. Baba Saheb fill this task. So a layman administering, first of all, it has something, the symbolism, very clear that this is not part of the lay-monk split. It's something that transcends that. And Dr. Ambedkar made very clear later that any experienced lay person could administer the refuges and precepts. They could conduct conversion ceremonies. Again, this is quite unprecedented in Buddhist history.
And that's followed, is it?
Absolutely. Like on that occasion when we showed you the pictures last night of those people in black from Tamil Nadu who had their conversion on the 2nd of October. Vivekaratna conducted the ceremony. The platform was full of monks. Chinese, Tibetan, Sri Lankan, Indian. And it wasn't even, senior people like myself. I said, well, Vivekaratna is a pretty senior order member. But, an Indian lay person conducted that ceremony. And that's very common. Although, increasingly, in larger contexts, monks will do it. So monks did it in Bombay. When I was in Delhi, 10,000 people converted. I was one of them. We were all invited to convert. We weren't asked if we were already Buddhists or not. Anyway, it was monks who did it. So I think it's honoured to some extent in the breach these days. Within TBMSG, quite clear. You don't, even if there's an Anagarika present, he may not be the one to conduct the ceremony. In fact, sometimes deliberately we won't have him do it.
This is possibly the first time that a lay person who participates in the ceremony, or is that not
true? Well, I can't say that, but probably, yeah.
It's the most significant time. When
I would say, certainly the most significant time. I mean, there have been lay Buddhist movements, but they're usually very strongly subordinative to the monastics. So, for instance, in Korea and China, and in Japan, you have lay Buddhist movements, but organized lay Buddhist movements, but they're very, very strongly sort of hierarchically dependent upon the monks. So it's a very strong statement. This is not to do with lifestyle, as Bhante would say, it's to do with commitment. Secondly, he made the vows, the 22 vows, integral to the ceremony. So, in those vows, first of all, the first thing is that you leave behind old allegiances, old refuges, gods and goddesses and practices connected with Hinduism. I have no faith in Brahma, Vishnu and Maheshwara, nor shall I worship them. I have no faith in Rama and Krishna, who are believed to be incarnation of God, nor shall I worship them. I do not believe in the incarnation of good, God. I do not and shall not believe that the Lord Buddha was the incarnation of Vishnu. I believe this to be sheer madness and false propaganda. I shall not perform Shraddha, nor shall I give Pindan. These are Hindu customary practices. To do with Shraddha is to do with death ceremonies, yeah. Is it? And Pindan is.
Yeah, it is also offering gifts in the name of the dead.
Ah, right. So I shall not allow any ceremonies to be formed by Brahmins. So the first 8 or 10 vows are to do with giving up Hinduism and caste-based practices. The next ones are all are to do with the social dimension of things. I shall believe in the equality of man. I shall endeavour to establish equality. And then the next ones are to do with practicing Buddhism. I shall follow the Noble Eightfold Path of the Buddha. I shall follow the 10 parameters prescribed by the Buddha. I shall have compassion and loving kindness for all beings and protect them. Or I think the best translation is, and nurture them with care. I shall not steal. I shall not tell lies. I shall not commit carnal sins, is the delightful translation here, sexual misconduct. Shall not take intoxicants like liquor, drugs, etc. I shall endeavour to follow the Noble Eightfold Path and practice compassion and loving kindness in everyday life. So that these vows are to do with lay people actively practicing the Dhamma, which in the Theravada context particularly is not really expected. The lay people are mainly expected to give dana. So what he's saying is that you're converting as active Buddhists, not merely as nominal Buddhists. Be active Buddhists. The last ones I'll just read because they're so powerful. I renounce Hinduism, which is harmful for humanity and impedes the advancement and development of humanity because it is based on inequality, and I adopt Buddhism as my religion. I firmly believe the Dhamma of the Buddha is the only true religion. I believe that I am having a rebirth. I solemnly declare and affirm that I shall hereafter lead my life according to the principles and teachings of the Buddha and his Dhamma. So you can see the mood. I'm leaving behind what goes before. I really will practice this. And I'm going to make an inner change of very strong conviction and pride, if you like, a positive pride. So he made all this integral to the conversion itself. And you heard Bhante speaking yesterday about how important he considers this to be. And where we've adopted this, Janosz, Tibor and I wrote out 22 vows in a car on the way to Pech. And we've amended them and developed them a bit further since. But we think this is very, very important in the situation in Hungary and no doubt in other places in Europe. Very important that people are clear that they're leaving behind superstition in this harmful kind and harmful social practices and really committing themselves, even if you know that's something that's much harder for them to do later. So what he's doing is saying that you are converting as genuine Buddhists. He's asserting the fundamental unity of the Buddhist Sangha, not dividing monks and laity and so on. So yes, you could say, well, Bhante analyzes it. First of all, that being a Buddhist means repudiating Hinduism. When you go for refuge to the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, you leave behind other refuges. God, gods, goddesses, whatever. Secondly, being a Buddhist as a full member of the Buddhist spiritual community, a united community. Thirdly, that a lay Buddhist is expected to practice as much as the monk. At the same time, Dr. Ambedkar was well aware of what a difficulty this was. He says elsewhere that Buddhism is a religion very difficult to practice. And that was the end of the ceremony. And as you know, Jnanasuri and 480,000 other people went back from where they came. I think it was 380,000 that day, another 100,000 the next day. They went back from where they came. They immediately threw out the gods and goddesses. They just, like the policeman said yesterday, they told their families, we're Buddhists now, get rid of the gods and goddesses. In some cases, they sort of looked at the 22 vows and tried to put them into practice. Vivekaratna was saying when we were talking with the Tibetans that when this happened in his village, I think he was actually present at the conversion. I can't remember. I think he was present, but anyway, his father was certainly there. And they converted, and all the Mahas in that village converted. And he said that the extraordinary atmosphere of confidence, of pride, of new beginning, a real cutting off of the old customs, fiercely cutting them off. You know, people get quite angry if anybody expected them to do these sort of ceremonies. You still encounter that today in some places, the older people particularly. They don't want anything to do with Hinduism. And, you know, that's why you have to be careful in Buddhism. If you, you know, a mantra, which we know to come from a quite different sort of Buddhist background, it's not Hindu at all. But even the sound of Om, they can't bear to hear. They can't bear it. And, I've had people say to me, look, I understand what you're saying, I believe you, but I don't want anything to do with that. I don't want even to be hearing that. Their feeling is so strong of rejection. Gets weaker with later generations, largely for worse rather than for better. And there's a gradual, and Vivekaratna said that within 3 or 4 years, his grandmother had started worshipping the gods again. There's a slow creep back. So you'd have the Buddha in the front room, Ganesh in the kitchen.
It's many families started now, you know.
Yeah.
Even some older members' family.
Oh, yeah. Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm afraid older members are not yet connected with their family.
Right.
It's my personal family also.
Oh, right.
Related, not family.
Not your immediate family. I won't accuse your mother. Yes. I'd get you into big trouble if I said, Aloka Shri says that you're worshipping the goddesses. Yeah, yeah. But I told the story of I went to give a talk in somebody's house. And, you know, there's a lovely shrine with a Buddha and so forth. Afterwards, I was invited into a back room to have a cup of tea. And I was sitting there having a cup of tea and I noticed there was some bookshelves. And I noticed that there were a pile of Hindu pictures, all sort of, they'd obviously been taken off the wall, put on the shelf when I walked through the door. And no doubt they go back. So I sort of picked one up and looked at it. Oh, what's this? And they look, oh, blah, 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 blah.
I did actually conduct my sister's marriage. She got married in December, yeah. Brahmin boy, and I conducted that ceremony in Buddhist way.
Of course you did. Yeah, yeah. So, it had a very, very powerful effect. It was really hard for us to understand because we just don't have that sort of culture. But extraordinary effect. It's interesting, when I was in North India this time, we did a retreat. Kumarajiv and Yashasagra and others, we did a retreat. And we had people from all North Indian states coming together. And they're people who've converted quite recently. And you got a flavour from them that you just don't get in Maharashtra anymore, of real sort of excitement and courage and a strength. You know, we don't mind nobody else in our village has converted, but we've converted. We don't care. And that sort of extraordinary courage that you really want to support and aid. The next day, Dr. Ambedkar conducted more conversions, I think about 100,000. And afterwards, he made that famous statement that I feel as if I've been released from hell. The hell of caste. And Bhante alluded to that yesterday, that just by becoming a Buddhist, nothing changes around you or outside you. But the inner change that's taken place does change things around you. And that's really what the conversion amounts to, is you're saying, this is in my hands, not in the hands of the caste people. This is in my hands. And, well, it's made the difference that we can see quite evidently. Well, Manidhamma and Aloka Shri and that that policeman yesterday, it's that sort of spirit that carried him to high power. So, yes, he made this point that anybody could conduct conversion and encouraged people to go out and do it. The next day he conducted conversions in Chandrapur, and then his plan was to move state by state, caste by caste, conducting conversions. Plans had been already made, but he went off to Nepal for a meeting of the World Fellowship of Buddhists, where he made a very, very important talk on the Buddha and Karl Marx. And he compared the Buddha and Karl Marx in his usual very, very pithy way. He got to the heart of the question, the difference. Marx essentially saying that change is a matter of historical forces. It's a scientific sort of process within society. But the Buddha saying that, no, it's the individual who fuels change. And he said that, my favourite quote, Manidhamma's favourite quote, that the greatest thing the Buddha has taught the world is that the world can only be reformed by the reformation of the mind of man and the reformation of the mind of the world. So reform ultimately is a reform of attitudes, understanding, and so on. And that's applicable everywhere. It's applicable in Hungary. It's applicable in England. It's applicable everywhere. You're not really going to get a major change by changing social structures. You will get some change. I mean, for instance, in Hungary, joining the European Union has made a big difference. But it's in the end, those peasants will retain their attitudes, many of them. Those caste-minded people will retain their attitudes. As we've seen, 60 years after independence, these extraordinarily primitive attitudes still exist. Those Rajputs, that was the most terrifying. Those Rajputs, I mean, he's quite a sort of almost noble man, wasn't he, with his moustaches and so on. He's a bit kind of admirable fierceness to him, but on such an ignoble view of humanity. We will never let them. We've got the stick. Horrible attitudes.
There's a pride in the Vans and the cruelty
inherent. There's a pride in their caste. Mm. And the cruelty is to keep them in their place. And you can see why the British found them extremely useful soldiers. So, it's the change in the mind that makes the difference. This is the ultimate point that Dr. Ambedkar has to make, and why Buddhism is the key. Because Buddhism calls for a change in mind and attitudes in a particularly clear way and gives very powerful tools for that change. Still, it's not easy. Buddhism is not an easy religion to put into practice because it's not all done for you. You can't just pray and wait for God to do it. You have to do it. Yeah? You can't just go to a priest and get absolution. You have to change your own mind and attitude. And that's not easy. And he said that to be a Buddhist, you need really to be an individual. You need to be prepared to stand alone. And he says that you need to train yourself. He said there's no freedom unless the mind is trained for freedom. So you have to train your mind so that you're a free person. Regardless of what anybody else thinks, you can be free. And it actually works. If you behave in a free way, others will not immediately change. But if they can't push you down, they will have to accept sooner or later. It may take generations, but they will have to accept. So this is the the conversion ceremony with its particular symbolism. They're very, very important to grasp some of the elements of that and to remember those when you're talking to people. Unfortunately, there has been a tendency for the Buddhist movement in Maharashtra to be Theravadinized. Dr. Ambedkar never selected any school. You've seen from what he said at the conversion ceremony that we're just Buddhists. It's a new departure in a way in Buddhism. But there's been a tendency for leaders to align themselves with Theravada. I'm not quite clear why. I think probably mainly because other forms of Buddhism have got such sort of Hindu-like dimensions to them. You heard that the policeman talking about, you know, well, no ritual in Buddhism. But actually there is ritual in Buddhism. Ritual is a way of training your mind. And to understand that some ritual is okay as long as it's not understood as an end in itself. Most people haven't grasped. It's a very strong rationalistic trend amongst leaders in the Buddhist world in Maharashtra. You know, people who know nothing really of Buddhism but will argue that Buddhism is just modern science sort of thing. So there's been a trend towards Theravadinizing and therefore to taking on monks. I mean, when I gave a talk, the keynote talk in Chandrapur on the 50th anniversary, and before I got on the platform, there was one of these Buddhist leaders. I think he was an academic of quite high standing, but he was just sort of raving on about, you know, how Mahayana, Vajrayana, these are all perversions, they're just Hinduism. And only Theravada is the true form of Buddhism. And he doesn't even know what they are. They're just words. But this sort of attitude is there. So there has been a tendency for conversions to be taken by monks. And there is a native Maharashtrian Bhikshu Sangha, but not of a very attractive kind, not very well trained. Initially, people who'd been Hindu sadhus would then put on the Buddhist robes to carry on their livelihood, as it were. Of course, that's not the case now, but and mainly because there just wasn't the follow-up that there needed to be. Even though the conversion made a huge difference in people's attitudes, it hasn't been followed through because Dr. Ambedkar died and wasn't able to establish the training institutes and so forth that would have created a cadre of the intelligentsia, as he put it, which really means the sort of cultural leaders that he wanted the Sangha to be, the Bhikshu Sangha to be. So, anything from those considerations so far? The symbolism of the conversion ceremony, the facts of the conversion ceremony. Anything from the situation in Hungary that...
So the question came in my mind, why didn't they not take that opportunity? Because of this one, he wanted to date a senior monk?
Oh yes, that's what he said. I mean, in a way, it was a question partly of etiquette and partly of impact. You think if Sangharakshita, an English monk, relatively junior in the Sangha, although he was by that time 56, he would have been ordained for only 6 years, not even a tera. If he'd conducted the ceremony, it just wouldn't have looked, in the Buddhist world, looked significant. So obviously you want to honour the importance of the occasion by having the most important person present, which in Buddhist context means the most senior, in other words, most long ordained. But it's interesting in Buddhism that the whole question of seniority status is resolved by simple arithmetic, if you see what I mean. The technical language is the number of reigns you've observed, the number of reigns retreats you've observed. In other words, the number of years you've been ordained. So monks, quite a bit of... if you see some sort of arguing on a platform, it's always about how many reigns they've observed and who should sit where. But in a way, it sort of solves a problem. Because, the length of service needs to be honoured and so forth, but it means you quite clearly can work out in a fairly rough, fairly... objective way, who is senior. So Uchandramani was quite an elderly man, very elderly man, been ordained since he was very young and highly respected.
Would some of those monks on the platform then have understood the significance of the conversions? Would they have really understood the caste issue, the untouched issue?
Probably to some extent not. Most of them were foreign, were either a Thai or Sri Lankan or Burmese. I don't know the full total. I know one of them, I've met one of them, who still lives. He's a very old man, lives in Lucknow. But, you know, for instance, that man, Panyanand. I think he does call himself Pragnanand, and that's significant. Because his name would have been in Pali, but he uses the Sanskrit, or therefore Hindi, form of it. And, I've talked to Buddhists in North India who are his disciples, and they speak of him as an extremely sensitive man who's very much a follower of Dr. Ambedkar, who has very much taken to heart the sort of Dalit cause. So, certainly he's one who showed that sort of spirit. Anand Kosilyan was there on the platform, I think. I think he was. And he was from a Brahmin background, actually, I think. But a communist. He became a communist.
Punjabi Brahmin.
Punjabi Brahmin, yeah. And then, became interested in Buddhism before any question of conversion took place. But many Brahmins did begin to look at Buddhism in the early part of the 20th century. There's some famous figures in Indian Buddhism, like Kashyapji. He was a Brahmin. I think he's a Brahmin. He might have been Kshatriya. Yeah, Brahmin. But there were three of them. And they ordained as Buddhist monks before any question of this social movement took place. But all of them embraced it fully. Anand Kosilyan was very highly respected. He only died quite recently. And Dr. Ambedkar is known to have said on more than one occasion that the only two bhikshus that his followers should trust were Anand Kosilyan and Sangharakshita. That's quite widely known. And there are even occasions on which he said the only one they should trust is Sangharakshita. Because Anand Kosilyan was a bit of a tricky man. he's a politician, sort of, or political thinker in background. A lovable rogue, I think I've heard him referred to as. And very much a supporter of the movement, and worked very hard for it. Without much real understanding more of the Buddhist side of it, if you see what I mean. So it'd been a bit of a mixed bag. There have been some Indian Buddhist monks like Anand Kosilyan, and mainly then foreign bhikshus like Pragnanand, who came from Sri Lanka. But most of them then got stuck in, but not very effectively on the whole. Anand Kosilyan did a bit more effectively. Yes, indeed.
The India Untouched. As you just said, it was about 6 weeks ago that it was filmed.
It was released. It was clearly about 2 years ago. It was probably the material started to be gathered. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so sort of that with, the changes in the mind of humankind.
Hmm.
And people going back to the old God.
Yeah.
So it's, I was thinking of, I think the question what is the change, basically?
Hmm.
It seems that we're looking at more at the, this needs to be done.
Yeah.
It was stressed.
I think there's some facts that you need to know before it's worth going any further, really.
Okay.
The fact is that the conversions have really only touched one caste in one state. And that the impact of that is huge,
yeah.
as I've already indicated. And not just in Manidhamma and Ala Kashri, as it were, and the Sahib yesterday, but in even changed attitudes amongst non-Buddhists. They are much more cautious about harming in Maharashtra, even though atrocities do take place and take place too much. That it's much less than in most other states.
I was trying to imagine myself as an ex, as Dalit.
Yeah.
I converted and I do believe wholeheartedly.
Yeah.
Change takes place in my heart.
Ah, right. Yes.
So, walk into a village. I had to take my shoes off.
Yeah.
And I walk and I said,
yeah.
And then I'm met with violence, basically.
Yeah, again, this is the fact I was trying to get across to you, that doesn't happen quite so overtly in Maharashtra. However, Maharashtrian Buddhists will be subjected to casteist things. I mean, like, we have a retreat centre in Bajie, which you saw some pictures of, and the village nearby has a water problem. We have water, sometimes they don't in the summer season. So often the village women will come to our retreat centre to get water, a Buddhist centre. And when, the women were coming, one day somebody noticed that all the Buddhist women were at the back, on Buddhist territory, as it were. The caste people and the Buddhist women themselves would naturally think that they should go to the back. And we just sort of brought them to the front, as it were. So, yeah, that happens all the time. And the effect is that many people then say, this doesn't work. And they'll say then, well, we must engage in politics, we must engage in violence, for instance. And you can understand. And part of the issue for me is that there just hasn't been enough support for what took place. And that's partly why we've begun to try to bring other Buddhists in and to get more support from the West. We're not doing enough. Even our TBMSG isn't doing enough. And we're not calling enough resources. People need a lot more support. And the movement also needs to go out to other communities. So, for instance, in villages where atrocities take place, one of the things that the higher caste will do is use one lot of Dalits against another. And often there's conflict between the different Dalit communities. So, if you've got much more solidarity amongst Dalits, at the political level that needs to be done too, as BSP is after, but also at the sort of level of culture and especially of belief. So it just hasn't been radical enough. It needs to be followed up much more vigorously. And people do lose heart. There's been a sort of revival. That's partly why we're so keen to get things moving again, because the 50th anniversary has sort of reawakened something of that spirit. But there's no doubt there's been a discouragement. Even in the time I've been going out, I've noticed the sort of fervour getting less. When I went out in 85, there's still, quite a strong sort of, yes, 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 we will do it. And, then it just gets sort of, it doesn't disappear, but it gets weaker. I don't know whether you'd agree with me, but that's certainly my observation. And you can understand. Because basically, India goes on. And I learned things from that film last night. I knew that it went on, but I didn't. I found out all the time just how extensive it is. Because it's unreported. It's unreported because it's unremarkable. It's just normal. I imagine you find the same in Hungary, that just some of the things that happen, nobody even knows about, because it's just what happens. So I think that's one of the things that we from the West can do, is help to give confidence. Because we continue to be confident about it, because we are, paying attention and interest, we sort of give more hope, without any virtue of our own, just by presence. So you can sort of keep it alive, and that's TBMSG has kept something alive.
And in some ways, it's something that's not going to, it may not change in our lifetime.
Sorry?
It may not change in our lifetime.
No, the caste system is going to take generations to go.
I think in my mind, partly what's happening is I spent 12 years studying social revolutions in Latin America.
Yeah.
there was this constant of Catholicism supporting. That's how they started, basically.
Yeah.
With the Vatican, Concilio Vaticano, in 68, with the Vatican.
Right, yeah. The Vatican II, yeah.
Yes. So then the priests had a lot to, support a lot of
yes.
And when I did the all-in, what came up was, the people got really kind of disheartened, and many of them left to join Marxists, and went war, basically.
Yeah.
It was this process of disheartened and constantly repressed.
There's an extremely important warning in that, and I have encountered that increasingly. People just saying, "What's the point? It doesn't work." Yeah, we're Buddhists. It's great. Let's have the Buddha on our flag, but come on, we've got to do something more political.
Yeah, but maybe what I'm thinking about is kind of support.
It needs much more support, because after all, the Vatican reined in its liberation theology dogs. I have a brother who's a priest, and he came in because of Vatican II, and he wanted to be a worker priest. And just at the point when he got ordained, worker priests were abolished. And, the Vatican really swung hard to the right because it was anti-communist, because the Polish president, Pope. The Vatican swung more towards the status quo, and their key issue was anti-communism. So if there had been more support, I don't know. My brother would have happily have gone and carried a gun and worn his cassock at the same time. And he tries to be a social revolutionary in King's Cross, which is badly needed. Let's make sure that Buddhism doesn't become establishment. And it needs far, far more support. I think that's a very good sort of lesson that you make, and would be a very good one to sort of pursue much more fully. There's a parallel. But of course, Buddhism is a different religion to Catholicism. And and one of the problems with Catholicism is paternalism. So it doesn't really invite people to take full self-responsibility. I mean, like in Hungary, I believe there's not a single gypsy priest. Are you correct? At the same time, there are Catholic welfare agencies helping gypsies. But it's all we helping them. I think that's the spirit of certainly the Catholic Church after Vatican II was sort of reversed. The only Christian groups that are really effective amongst gypsies are gypsy churches, which have gypsy priests and so on. Mm. I mean, something a little bit more positive than that, I think. But is that broadly correct, what I've said?
It's more than correct.
More than correct.
In South America, there are Catholic movements within the poor social strata.
Yeah.
But in East Europe, Catholic churches belongs to the feudal past.
Yeah. And I suppose also because of the communist regime, it is identified with anti-communism.
Yes.
Slightly cautious about using this particular expression. Maybe there's a better one, but in a way, what's needed is constant revolution.
Yes.
Because as soon as a hierarchy is established and someone becomes senior, everything settles down and the old, as it were, problems arise. So reinvigoration. Awkwardness in a way.
Well, Dr. Ambedkar had a very interesting set of, again, penetrating but not fully worked out ideas there, revolution and counter-revolution. He wrote a paper about it, and he regards, first of all, the Buddha as the first revolutionary, as it did make a huge social revolution in India, with his attack on caste, his equality, and so on. And then that gradually got eroded. Ashoka reinvigorated it, and for instance disrobed many monks because they were wearing the sacred thread under their robes. There's records of that. And he reformed the Sangha, especially in those terms, which sort of got rid of Hindu practices, which were essentially Brahminical practices. A counter-revolution took place, under which India lives today. So effective a counter-revolution that not a trace of the Buddha remained. Nobody in India knew that the Buddha was a historical figure. I guess for several of us in India, Indian Order members and some, myself and Loka Mitra, we've been faced by this, the magnitude of the situation, but also the potential. The conclusion we've come to is that we need to focus on training, education, but in Dr. Ambedkar's message in a fuller way than we've done up until now and than anybody else has done, and on a much larger scale. So that's our conclusion. We need more people who can support this movement. That's the easiest, you know, you can't do much by yourself, but if you can train other people, you can do so much. You must have experienced this in your own work.